Okay, colleagues, good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 3rd of June, another very packed schedule. I'd like to welcome our colleagues from Florida State University, if that's not incorrect. Yes, so welcome to our press briefing. We have a very busy briefing. We'll start off immediately with Sena of the International Labor Organization for an update on the ILC, the International Labor Conference. We have colleagues who are going to speak to the Central African Forest Initiative. Colleagues will speak to the situation on Gaza, Chad, Sudan, South Sudan, and World Food Safety Day. So quite a packed agenda, but immediately throw to Sena for an ILC update.
Thank you very much, Rollo, and again, welcome. It's always nice to have students among us. Colleagues, thank you to all those who attended the DG Breakfast. We were very happy to welcome you. I'm here to give you an update on the International Labor Conference. It's the 113th ILC held here in Geneva. Just a couple of logistical points. The first one is you're able to get the most up-to-date schedule for the day when you go to daily program. And that would be my advice to you is double check it if you're interested indeed the night before because it keeps on changing. And in order to be able to access the daily program, you go on to www.ilo.org/international-labor-conference. Or you could just Google ILO ILC and you'll get there. And then from there on, you choose the 113th session of the ILC. And if you scroll down, you will see daily program. So you just click on it and you get the most up-to-date information. I also wanted to give you a little bit of information on the protocol around the 12th of June, which is when heads of states are expected to attend the Global Coalition for Social Justice Forum. Last year, you may remember that we held our first forum ever. This year, we're holding the second. We don't have a list yet, a finalized list of who are the heads of states, but just to let you know that if you go to door 40, in the main Palais building, you will see a red carpet, which is the VIP section, and there's a section there for journalists. You are welcome to come to ask questions if you have questions, and of course, it's up to the heads of state and their mission whether they would like to answer or not. But it is not restricted to journalists. You are able to come and stand there. The other thing I'd like to let you know is we sent you the list of some of the events taking place in the ILC engagement zone. That is the zone that is basically open to our constituents and the public with some curated events during the lunch hour, including the ILC conversations where we have panel discussions, not nearly as technical as what you have inside the meeting rooms on a number of topics, including sustainability and business, AI, and the world of work, and just transitions, as well as the upcoming second summit for social development, which is taking place in the fall in Doha. Just some of the events in case you're interested. And last but not least, the Malaysian mission has requested us to let you know that the Minister of Human Resources for Malaysia, Mr. Stephen Slim, will be in town for the ILC from the 8th till the 10th of June, and he is open to any interviews should there be an interest from the media to speak to him. If there is, let us know, and we'll put you directly in touch with the mission. And that's it from my end. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sena. Do we have questions? Yes, Emma, Reuters.
Hey, good morning. I was just wondering, could you tell me what the Finance Committee will be deciding at the ILC exactly? Is it the budget? If you could just talk me through that. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that question, Emma. Indeed, the Finance Committee will be deciding on the budget and the program of the ILO for 2026 and 2027.
Okay, thank you. Jamie.
Hi, Zane. Which heads of state have you got confirmed for the 12th?
We do not have confirmations yet, but I will make sure to share them with you guys as soon as we do.
Okay, thank you for the... Yes, AFP.
Yes, thank you. On the budget, could you let us know if it will be possible to follow that online? When exactly? Because we have many things going on, so we can know. It's very difficult for us to look at everything, to watch everything. If you could let us know, and if you plan to publish a press release once it's adopted after. Thank you.
Yes, I will get back to you on both.
Great. Thanks so much, Sain. I think that does it. No one online is asking, so thank you again. Good luck for the remaining session. I think we'll start with UNHCR. Jeremy, we'll go to you just afterwards, if that's okay with you. So, Eugene, there you are. If you can come up from a UNHCR who has a guest joining us from Chad, and is going to speak to the Sudanese the refugee situation in Chad, in fact. And I think you also have something of South Sudan as well. But over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm here today to present our area coordinator, Patrice, who is at the moment at the border of Chad and Sudan, who will brief you about the situation, current situation there. But to start with, because he will focus on the situation in Chad with the recent attack in Darfur region, but also to highlight that as of yesterday, 4 million people now fled Sudan into neighboring country since the start of the war, now in its third year, the 4 million people, a devastating milestone in what is the world's most damaging displacement crisis at the moment. If the conflict continues in Sudan, 1,000 more people will continue to flee, putting regional and global stability at stake. So you will hear more about the situation in Chad, specifically those Sudanese refugees fled from Darfur region. Over to you, Patrice.
Thank you very much, Jill. I hope you can hear. Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to join you this morning from Amjaras. Amjaras is in the far north of Eastern Chad, one of the locations receiving Sudanese refugees since April 2023. My briefing today is happening in a context characterized by two key realities. The first reality is that in Chad, the Sudanese refugees has tripled from 2003 to 2025. For your information, from 2003, the first conflict, to April 2023, Chad has hosted 400,000 refugees from Sudan. And from April 2023, the ongoing conflict, to date, May 2025, more than 800,000 refugees more has crossed into Chad, bringing the total of refugees, the total of Sudanese refugees in Chad to 1.2 million. Say the number of Sudanese refugees has tripled. So this shows you the scale of the displacement, and also the seriousness of the crisis and of the situation that civilians are undergoing, you know, in Sudan. The second reality is important also to highlight is that a month ago we briefed you on the consequences of the recent attack and also ongoing attack in northern Darfur. Unfortunately, a month after this recent attack, more than 70,000 new refugees has crossed into Chad, especially in the Wadi Fira province and also in the Ennedi East province, where I am today, two provinces that are in the far north of the eastern part of Chad. So refugees are coming in very dire situation. You know, what they are reporting to us is difficult to hear. Horrendous stories of human rights violation. They are fleeing in terror, many under fire, extortion, as they reported to us. our protection, UNHCR protection monitoring team, you know, has been able to interview more than 7,000 households in protection interview, and what they are reporting harrowing account of violence. 72% of those interviewed report serious human rights violations, physical and sexual violence, arbitrary detention, forced recruitment. 60% of them say that they have been separated from the family members. So this shows you the family separation situation in which the refugees are here. 66% of school-age children, you know, are out of school and have not been able to go to school for the last 3 years, even before they cross into Chad. Among those affected, 3 weeks ago exactly, I was in this location, especially in the refugee settlement called Urekasuni, and I met a little girl called Hawa. Hawa crossed into Chad with her older sister, who is 18. What Awa and her sister, Awa is a little girl of 7 years old, and what they told me is difficult to hear, but I would like to share this story with you so that you understand more, you know, the violations and the violence that civilians are going through. Awa and her families were living in Zamzam. The house has been attacked. Awa lost her mother in this air bombing. They decided to move to the Zamzam IDP camps. There again, there have been aerial bombing. And then Awa lost her father this time and two of her siblings. Awa survived major injuries. Unfortunately, one of her legs had to be amputated. It's difficult to hear, but this is the reality. So Awa and her sister of 18 years old, they decided to cross into Chad in a very, very difficult context. Many restrictions on the way, extortion of property. And today Awa is in Amjaras in a very devastating, not only physical, but also psychological damage. So our story is one of the countless stories that we are hearing here in Eastern Chad, especially from the Sudanese refugees. There are many, many, many Hawas who face a similar situation or situation that are even difficult to talk about here. So jointly with other actors, we have been providing response. With local authorities, host communities, UN agencies, NGOs. But unfortunately, the response is dangerously underfunded because to date, shelter condition has dire. We've been able only to provide 14% or to address 14% of the shelter needs. It's exposing refugees to, you know, physical security, physical insecurity, and also some violence. Water, we've been able to provide, or we have been providing only 5 liters per person per day. And we all know that the standard is between 15 and 20 liters, according to the international standard. So 5 liters for all the basic needs, it's difficult for the refugees to survive, you know, in this kind of situation. So the needs are huge. Mental health and psychosocial support are urgent to address. Immediate recovery also very urgent to address, not only, you know, for the health, but also for reconciliation purpose. A last point important also to say is that due to this underfunding situation, more than 290,000 refugees are still stranded at the border, exposed to many, many types of insecurity incident. So I would like to use this opportunity to call upon, you know, the global community to acknowledge and act in order to eradicate the horrendous human rights abuses that civilians are enduring and what they have been telling us here as refugees. As part of the Sudan Regional Refugee Response Plan, UNHCR and all the partners in Chad we are urgently seeking $553 million to respond to life-saving needs of refugees and also of the host communities that have been sharing with them what they don't even have, or the little they have sometimes. So this will help us to address, you know, urgent needs in water, in shelter, in food, sanitation, healthcare, and most importantly, mental health and psychosocial supports. This is a crisis that, this is unprecedented crisis that we are facing. This is a crisis of humanity. This is a crisis of safety, and this is a crisis of protection based on the violation and the violence that refugees are reporting. So the lives and future of millions of innocent civilians, including children like Hawa, hang in the balance. Without a significant increase in funding, life-saving assistance cannot be delivered at the scale and at the speed that is required. Thank you for your attention. Over to you.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much, Patrice. As difficult as it is to hear this, as you say yourself, it's important that you do to spotlight this crisis. And of course, it would be remiss of me if I didn't mention, of course, what the SG Secretary General has been saying since the beginning of this conflict. We need more resources, we need to end of this conflict, and we need a flow of aid to those most in need. So thank you very much. Let's start with questions, if any, in the room. Yes, Imogen of BBC. Imogen.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't catch. What's the appeal, the figure, and where do you think you're going to get it from? Do you have any countries in mind?
Did you get the question, Patrice? Yep. I don't know if...
Yes, okay. Yes, I got the question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
No, we are talking to many donors. The appeal has been launched early this year, and we are talking to many donors, including the private sector donors, in order to be able to address the life saving assistance. So here is not only one country. We're talking to all the traditional donors. Still talking to US. We're talking to Great Britain. We're talking to all the multilateral donors and also the private sector donors. Of course, our engagement with development actors also in Chad, you know, is more important today, because what is happening here is, yes, we have all the humanitarian needs, but at the same time, refugees are coming in areas where they are underlying development crisis or development needs. So we are engaging also more with development actors. I'm talking about the African Development Bank, the World Bank, the INTPAR, to ensure that the situation in the refugee hosting areas, you know, can also be addressed through the development funding. And of course, we are also actively talking to the government to see how the development funding that they have received, but they have not been able to use them, you know, how this funding can be, you know, can target, you know, all these areas that are hosting refugees, so that at the end of the day, it becomes beneficial for not only for refugees but also for host communities. So this is how we are engaging all the donors. Over.
Just add to what Patricia said, just to respond to you, Imogen. So in 2025, a humanitarian partner is what we call the Sudan Regional Refugee Response. We are calling the $1.8 billion to support the 4.8 million people, including refugee returnees and local host community, and as well as a third country national. What Patrice is referring is just the Chad part of it, Chad part of the funding that they needed, $553 million. You will receive the note and then it will include all the detail. Thanks.
Thank you both, and for the clarification as well. For the questions in the room, yes, Emma of Reuters.
Good morning. I know that some of these refugees have probably come from North Darfur, from the Al-Fashir region. we understand that a convoy delivering much needed food to there was attacked today. If you know anything about that, I'd like to hear it. But more broadly, can you describe what the situation is in Al-Fashir based on testimonies of people arriving? How bad is it? How long have they been cut off from supplies? Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, no, thank you. Just 2 points, maybe, and Eugene might add. For the first one, the convoy that has been attacked recently, I mean, I've not heard about it, but what refugees are telling us that their convoys attack every day. But for the second question, the situation as reported by refugees, you know, on this side, what they are saying is that first week of April, when the attack on El Fasher, most important, and especially on Zamzam started, there have been 300 civilians who died, and some refugees or some internal IDPs, internally displaced people, decided to go in other parts of Darfur, and others decided to cross the border into Chad. They are still reporting many, many, many violations. For instance, they say to us that it's difficult today to leave El Fasher because there are restrictions. You are authorized to leave El Fasher only, especially Tawila, which is where there is a huge concentration of civilians, only on Monday and on Thursday. The rest of the week, you are not allowed to leave the town. So making it very difficult for the civilians to leave. The transportation cost is huge, and people are working for 3 days, 4 days, depending on where they are, if you are in Zamzam or Tawila. So they have to work for days and days. We also got report of refugees who say that it's very, 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 very hot these days. And some people, because of lack of water or scarcity of water, they have seen many people who died during the journey to Chad. Another harrowing story that I heard personally is a story of Amadou, who told me that the practice that armed groups are having in El Fasher is that you see these charrettes that they use for transportation. They use the donkey, they use the horse, and then the family members, you know, are already, you know, on the charrette. So the practice today is that when armed groups see you leaving, they decide to let the donkey or the horse go, and you, as a human being, as a man, of course, they will use you as a horse and ask you now to draw, you know, all your family members. So this is a forced labor situation, very difficult to hear, but this is what refugees are telling us. Let me stop there. There are many, 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 many violence happening according to what we are hearing. So it's urgent, you know, to give visibility to these violations, so that at least civilians can be able, you know, to seek further protection if protection is not available or is not possible in northern Darfur or in other part of Darfur. Last point is, due to the checkpoints that are on the road, some civilians, when they are coming to Chad, they have to do a U-turn. They move, they leave the northern part of Darfur, and they have to go through the western part of Darfur. And according to them, there are less checkpoints, there are less killings. And of course, they are talking about systematic killings and also forced recruitment of men. That is why today, in the new displacement contest, you have about 90% who are women and girls. Over.
I would just add the assault, recent assault on the displacement camp, including Zamzam and Abu Shuk and El Fasher town, killed more than 300 civilians. That's the report that we're hearing, including the humanitarian staff member. This area has been under siege for a year already. And then cutting off 100,000 people in this area from life-saving humanitarian aid and farming condition have already identified in Zamzam. So this recent assault really forced this desperate family even at the breaking point. And then even they went to Tabwila town, which they have access of some of the humanitarian aid that the humanitarian agency present there. But we really need unhindered and sustained humanitarian access to those people. And that's what a humanitarian agency working in those areas is repeatedly telling. And then you hear the story of how this is one of thousands of children, which breaking my heart, and I'm sure that what you are hearing today is also breaking your heart as well. So please, that we really need those access, humanitarian access to those people.
Thank you. And if you just allow me to add more really just to point you to the statement we issued earlier this week from the UN resident humanitarian coordinator, Christine Humbrook, who echoed what we just heard from our colleagues. And in these attacks, there was an attack on a hospital in northern Kordofan state, Al Obeid Hospital, where aid workers were killed. These are people who are putting their lives in the line to provide these vital services, not to mention the countless civilians killed, the relentless shelling in El Fasher closer to the Chad border, as we just heard from Patrice. So do take a look at that statement, which we continue to issue, and hopefully there'll be some respite in this horrific conflict. So let's take question from Jamie in the room, and then we'll have another one online. So Jamie, AP.
Thank you. Hi, thank you. Hi, Eugene. And thank you, Patrice. I just wanted to make sure that the $4 million you're talking about was specifically Chad that you're talking about. And is that for the, and so could you just give us the broader context on that? And then also, how does that compare to other refugee crises that we're facing?
So 4 million I mentioned is the people from Sudan, that including refugee and returnee in neighboring country. So the inside of the country, of course, so we are talking about more than 9 million internally displaced people, which make 13 million people from Sudan displaced.
So of those, how many are going to Chad? Can you just break it down for the other countries?
From Chad, as the Patrice mentioned, that what we call the last 2 years is 800, almost like more than 800,000, which make in total refugee, Sudanese refugee in Chad 1.2 million. So if we're talking about the recent last 2 years, 800,000, and then previously the Chad already hosted the Sudanese refugee from Darfur region since 2003, that's 400,000, so in total 1.2 million.
Thank you for that, Eugene. We have another question for you. Gabby of Proceso of Mexico. Gabriela, if we can unmute Gabby.
Oui?
Okay, go ahead, Gabby.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to know if you have an estimate of how many children are affected.
Patrice, if you can shed light on that that angle.
Yes. I can say, you know, all the children are affected depending on which sector we are talking about. When it's come to mental health and psychosocial support, all the children are affected. When it's come to who we can call the war wounded, because there are many children who are coming, you know, wounded. We have identified so far 30 of them who are wounded, seriously wounded. But in total, when we talk about children who are at risk, either in a family separation situation or unaccompanied children, In total, we are talking about 752 children, you know, who are in this kind of situation.
And to just add that this crisis is a woman and children's crisis. That I visited Chad at the beginning of the crisis. I've never seen that so many women and children crossing the border every day. We're talking about almost, correct me, Patrice, if I'm wrong, almost 90% are women and children. So you can imagine that the situation there. Jamie mentioned that how serious I've been in Syria crisis, South Sudan crisis, this one. I've never seen that how many women and children crossing the border every day. So you can see the seriousness of this crisis.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much. Gabby, is that a follow-up?
Well, not exactly a follow-up. Thank you for the answer. But, you know, I'm outside here in the parking. And they say that the parking for the press, we have to pay?
Gabby, this is something that we can discuss afterwards, and as is a housekeeping matter. So let's please discuss this outside this briefing, if you don't mind. Thank you very much,
Gabby.
Okay,
sorry.
Okay. Staying on the region, we have, I think, Eugene, you have a statement on South Sudan. So let's hear that from you, and then we'll then turn to Gaza afterwards. But over to you.
Oh, sorry.
Let me just, excuse me. Patrice, thank you very much, firstly, for the work you're doing, for the work of you and your colleagues are doing in this precarious situation. So, and please do join us anytime at this press briefing here in Geneva. Thank you very much, sir.
Unfortunately, we'll cross the border and then have another crisis, ongoing crisis, I would say that because, as I mentioned, that I was in South Sudan for 4 years, and then this is the crisis I have witnessed it like a long time ago, and then which continues. You will receive the detailed the press brief press release later today, but I'm just giving you the picture that since late February the conflict started in South Sudan, in particularly in Upper Nile State, that over 165,000 people have fled increasing tension and conflict in South Sudan, inside of South Sudan, and also that across the border. I will just stop here. Because you will receive our press release later today.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions on South Sudan since we have Eugene here? No? Okay, I think we'll look after that press release. So thank you very, very much. Okay, we're moving to another region, one that we've been briefing on for a long time now. Situation in Gaza. We have Jeremy of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who is going to address the attacks on aid distribution sites in Gaza. Jeremy.
Yes, thanks, Rolla. And good morning, everyone. You will have just received a statement from the High Commissioner in the past 5 minutes. I'll read out that statement for you now. Deadly attacks on distraught civilians trying to access the paltry amounts of food aid in Gaza are unconscionable. For a third day running, people were killed around an aid distribution site run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. This morning, we received information that dozens more people were killed and injured. There must be a prompt and impartial investigation into each of these attacks and those responsible held to account. Attacks directed against civilians constitute a grave breach of international law and a war crime. Palestinians have been presented the grimmest of choices: die from starvation or risk being killed while trying to access the meagre food that is being made available through Israel's militarised humanitarian assistance mechanism. This militarised system endangers lives and violates international standards on aid distribution, as the United Nations has repeatedly warned. The willful impediment of access to food and other life-sustaining relief supplies for civilians may constitute a war crime. The threat of starvation together with 20 months of killing of civilians and destruction on a massive scale, repeated forced displacements, intolerable, dehumanizing rhetoric and threats by Israel's leadership to empty the strip of its population, also constitute elements of the most serious crimes under international law. In 2024, the International Court of Justice found that there was a real and imminent risk of irreparable prejudice to the rights of Palestinians in Gaza under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. The court issued binding orders on Israel to take all necessary and effective measures to ensure, without delay, in full cooperation with the United Nations, the unhindered provision at scale by all concerned of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance, including food, water, electricity, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene, and sanitation requirements, as well as medical supplies and medical care to Palestinians throughout Gaza. There is no justification for failing to comply with these obligations.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. And of course, as you're well aware, the Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also called for an immediate independent investigation into the events where people who are simply risking their lives to obtain food in this very, very difficult setting. And of course, SG has condemned these killings. So we'll take questions now, turning to the room. Jamie, AP.
Good morning, Jeremy. Thank you. Can you give us more details? We've obviously got reports from officials in Gaza already talking about we've got a figure of 27 currently. Are you talking about that same a number of people? Is that a different incident? Can you be specific about where and when this happened? Just give us a few more details on the dozens more killed and injured that you're referring to, please. Thanks.
Yes, thanks, Jamie. So the information we have is roughly the same as what you have. 27 killed, including three women. We are aware that children were amongst the crowd on all three occasions. We don't have any information on children, child fatalities, but you've seen what's happened over the past 3 days. All incidents have taken place near the Al Alam roundabout, near the distribution centre. The details we have, we're also getting our own information from on the ground, which are verifying the information that we've received.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Further questions in the room first. We have one online. Yes, Robin, AFP.
Good morning. Mr. Jonathan Whittle, who is the OPT head of office for OCHA, he described this new distribution mechanism as being, quote, essentially engineered scarcity. Do you think that is a reasonable description of the conditions that people are facing there with regard to their human rights?
The High Commissioner has spoken strongly on this with respect to how this flies in the face of humanitarian aid principles. Not only that, the principles, but we're talking about dignity here. Dignity of those who are desperately distraught people trying to get food just to survive. Simple as that.
Absolutely. Questions in the room before turning online? Okay, I think that's it. So back to you, Gabby. Proceso.
Yes. Can you repeat what you said in your statement about genocide?
I'll happily read it out for you again, Gabby. I'll read the whole paragraph. On genocide, we were referring to the International Court of Justice, which found that there was a real and imminent risk of irreparable prejudice to the rights of Palestinians in Gaza under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. We remind you, the court issued binding orders on Israel to take all necessary and effective measures to ensure without delay, in full cooperation with the United Nations, the unhindered provision at scale by all concerned of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. And then the High Commissioner continues, this includes food, water, electricity, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene, and sanitation requirements, as well as medical supplies and medical care for all Palestinians throughout Gaza.
Gabby, in the room now.
Who is Israel is responsible, but who has to face the justice, international justice, or who can refer this case to the international court, or someone has to be judged for this crime against humanity?
These crimes would be heard by, first of all, local courts, national courts, and then if it necessitates, it would go to the international courts. That may be the International Criminal Court. Our office gathers evidence, and we share that evidence.
And of course, there's the work of the Commission of Inquiry that are also gathering, monitoring, and investigating these horrific acts. Yep. Colleagues, any further questions for Jeremy on Gaza? Yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
Thank you. So there's this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that there's not a whole lot of clarity as to who's behind it and who's running it and whatnot. You mentioned the possible prosecution. I mean, do you have any clarity as to who these people are and whether or not they in any way could be responsible for, Robin just mentioned, the selective, or what is it, scarcity? That in other words, is there any possibility that those people also could be held to account for what's happening right now in connection with these efforts to distribute aid?
Thanks, Jamie. So I think there's so much which has happened in the past 3 days, apart from the tragic circumstances of human beings trying to gather food to survive and then being killed in the process. There are questions being asked, who did this? And that's why we call for a full, independent, prompt, impartial investigation into these acts.
Thank you. Okay, sparked more questions here. Okay, and yes, AFP.
Yes, thank you. My memory is not very well functioning, so I was wondering, in the past, when the distribution was done by the United Nations or the several UN agencies, do you remember if there has been any such attacks? Thank you.
With respect to that, I think you're probably better off asking the UN agencies who are delivering the aid. What I will say is that the aid, when it was being delivered by the likes of OCHA and UNRWA, who did such an amazing job, have been for years upon years doing this work, they delivered aid and helped Gazans who were in desperate need. They took the aid to the Gazans, as opposed to the situation now. Gazans are having to walk miles, those who can walk and who are fit enough. So we're excluding children, we're excluding elderly people, we're excluding people with disabilities. They have been forced to walk to these centres And now they're terrified, probably. They go there and they're thinking, am I going to get food or am I going to get shot?
Yeah, let me just say, because I feel compelled to do so, you know, we've been speaking from here and talking about so many attacks, which it's almost as if they're hard to qualify and quantify even. There have been attacks on health workers. There have been attacks on civilians, of course. More than 50,000 people killed, women, children, the big bear the brunt of this. It's hard to enumerate. There have been attacks, indeed, when people are collecting food. I can't tell you specifically when. I invite colleagues who are online maybe to provide some granularity on that, but the fact is this is a surreal setting in which people are just trying to live their lives in decency, and they've been under attack relentlessly for months on end. But of course, if you have any specific examples that you want to draw and compare to, we can try to get that for you, Agnes. Nick, New York Times.
Thank you. Yeah, Jeremy, I just wondered if you had a casualty count for the last 3 days altogether. And I wondered if also when you were referring to the most serious international crimes, could you just confirm that you are explicitly including the crime of genocide in that? Thank you.
Yes, Nick. I'll go through my notes. What I have at this time from on the tally of those killed. On June 1, it was 32 Palestinians were killed. Yesterday, it was 3. And today, the latest number, we have 27. Now, those numbers could well have changed. I'm just sharing you the latest we have. When it comes to when we talk about the most serious crimes under international law. Let me refer you to that first paragraph where we talk about war crimes and the willful impediment of access to food and other life-sustaining relief supplies for civilians, which may constitute a war crime. Then we list a litany of other elements which raise serious concerns. These other elements are elements which are the most serious crimes under international law. Nick, you know full well what those crimes are. War crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Is that a follow-up, Nick?
Yes, it is. Thanks. Thanks for that clarification, Jeremy. I also wondered, we've had a lot of reports about the scale of the attacks carried out in the last 3 days and the range of kind of forces that have been engaged in them. And we've heard of helicopters, of naval vessels involved, of tanks and of ground troops. Can you, do your reports confirm all those? Thank you.
We are aware of those reports as well, Nick. My colleagues who are working on the ground have interviewed, conducted interviews with witnesses, and they do report fire from their IDF on those trying to access the food distribution centres. We have received reports from other organisations on the ground to a similar effect.
Thanks again, Jeremy. Okay, Gabby, thinks this may be the last question. Gabby.
Yes, thank you. With your experience in human rights issues, how can you explain that a country that has suffered terrible things like Israeli passing through, how do you explain that they are so cruel with the Palestinians?
Gabby, that's not really a question I'd be in a position to answer. What I can say is that whereas the Human Rights Office repeatedly point out the violations of, fortunately, we've got, makes it easy, we've got IHL international humanitarian law and human rights law. And we base all our findings on the law. And the law we trust, and we will examine it closely, and the actions that take place in Gaza with respect to that.
Thanks again, Jeremy. Okay, I think that does it for the questions on Gaza. So thank you, as always, Jeremy, for joining us here. Extremely important briefing, and thanks to colleagues for reporting on this. Did you have a quick question for you?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. Go ahead. It's important.
Jeremy, just one last thing. There is a media operation for Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and to my knowledge, they have said up until now that there have not been any incidents in which there have been, let me just give you the exact language, if you don't mind. The Humanitarian Foundation says there's been no violence in or around the distribution sites. What do you say to that?
Jamie, we've gathered our own information. We've spoken to witnesses on the ground who have shared what they have seen, heard, and felt themselves. What I would also point out is, you may not have seen it, the IDF did issue a tweet this morning to explain what happened, their version of events of what happened.
Thank you. Last question, Gabby.
Yes. Did the High Commissioner try to speak with Mr. Netanyahu about this issue? Thank you.
The High Commissioner has repeatedly tried to engage with the Israelis, not only on the issues that are taking place on the ground, but also for our office to gain full access to Israel. Full access to Israel and to Gaza and the other occupied Palestinian territories. He will continue to do so.
This is obviously key. Okay, thank you again, Jeremy, as always, my friend. Please keep coming here, and you and your colleagues briefing us on this important story. So thanks. Okay, we're going to shift colleagues to another subject. We have two more briefers. I see you, Estelle, that you're welcome to come up, but we have one more brief beforehand. But we have colleagues joining us, both from Rome, I believe. Marcus Lipp, who is the Food and Agricultural Organization's Senior Food Safety Officer, and Simone Moraes Russell, who's a scientist, Department of Nutrition and Food Safety at WHO, who are both joining us. I think maybe one is from Geneva, one is from Rome, but on an important subject of World Food Safety Day. So maybe we'll start with you, Mr. Lipp.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good day, everybody. Sorry, it's going to be a little bit of a hard transition. But we wanted to present the World Food Safety Day, 7th of June, which is, of course, this year on a Saturday. So we will have celebrations or, let's say, events to highlight the need and the importance of food safety before, in the week before and the week after of the 7th of June. So this year's theme is food safety, science, and actions. And we believe that this theme reminds us of something very, very fundamental, and that is science is how we make sense of the world, we all together. It gives us a shared way to explain that what we see and to measure what matters. And afterwards, to talk about risks. This is where the work of FAO, together with WHO, comes in. Through our joint scientific advice program, Food Safety Scientific Advice Program, we pool the best science available from across the countries and disciplines to define the core elements of what is food safety, what is the appropriate level of food safety, and that applies to all the consumers everywhere. It's not really about imposing one's systems on everyone. It's about what we share. It's what we share scientifically and what we share as a foundation for any kind of action and policies. Building on that, on the science, the risk management through the members countries at the Codex Alimentarius Commission takes additional factors into account. It could be called a local context or cultural norms or other things. And that's where actually science meets, really, the consumers. Codex will help, and the members of the Codex committees will help to balance these pluralistic needs that we have in all of our societies and come up with a unified commitment to protecting public health and ensuring fair practices to trade. So today, let's be clear, we need science, yes, but not as a top-down approach, as a distant authority, but as a science is a shared understanding, a shared language, and a shared way of communicating our interests and even our differences with respect and with clarity. When we use science this way, we are not just managing food safety, we're building trust. Trust between consumers, producers, between regulators, industries, and between countries trading across borders. At FAO, we believe food safety isn't just about preventing harm. It is about creating confidence, creating trust, creating a shared reality. Confidence in the food and trust in the food that we eat, in the systems that protect us, that protect food safety, and in the institutions that serve the public good for safe food. So as we mark the World Food Safety Day on June 7th, let's keep that message front and center. Science is more than facts. It is a belief in shared knowledge, a shared reality. And when it's used wisely, openly, and inclusively, it becomes one of our most powerful tools for protecting public health, enabling fair practices in trade, and uniting people around a shared goal that is safe food for everyone. So please join us for celebrating World Food Safety Day on or around June 7th this year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lip. We now will hear from Ms. Russell of WHO.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. Food safety is not a given. It's a global responsibility. The theme of the World Food Safety Day is Food Safety Science in Action, as mentioned by my colleague Marcus, highlights the essential role of science in protecting our food supply and ultimately our health. Every day, 1.6 million people around the world fall ill due to unsafe food. These illnesses are preventable, and the science to prevent them already exists. What we need is action, coordinated, evidence-based, and inclusive action. The World Health Organization, in collaboration with FAO, plays a central role in this effort. Through the joint FAO-WHO Scientific Advice Program, WHO provides the scientific foundation for international food safety standards. This year, we mark two occasions. First is the joint FAO-WHO Expert Committee on Food Additives that will hold its 100th anniversary meeting, and the Expert Meeting on Microbiological Risk Assessment that celebrates its 25 years. The work of these and other groups guides national policies, informs regulations, and ensures that food trade across borders is safe for all consumers. WHO also supports countries in strengthening their food safety system by improving surveillance, responding to outbreaks, and building capacity in laboratories and regulatory agencies. This work is especially critical in low and middle-income countries, where the burden of foodborne diseases is highest. On the occasion of the World Food Safety Day, WHO is hosting health talks on food safety from today until tomorrow to highlight how science drives progress in food safety. However, food safety is not just the responsibility of governments or international organizations. It's everyone's business. Policymakers must invest in science-based regulations in data systems. Food business must implement rigorous safety practices and support transparency. Academia must continue to innovate and educate, and consumers, all of us, must stay informed and practice safe food handling at home. Because every one of us is a risk manager. Every decision we make, from how we store leftovers or how we read expiration dates, can help to prevent illness. Let us recognize the scientists, inspectors, and public health professionals who work behind the scenes every day. Their work is often invisible, but vital. So today, Let's raise awareness and commit to action. Let's ensure that science is not just studied, but applied. Let's build a future where safe food is a right, not a privilege. Because if it's not safe, it's not food. Join us to celebrate the World Food Safe Day. Thank you.
Thank you both very much to sound out these incredibly important messages. Do we have questions? Yes, Gabby.
Thank you. Has your office tried to send food to Gaza by air? I heard that the UN occasionally drops packages with food and medicines and things like this. So my question is on food, if your office tried to do that with the, to send to Gaza. Thank you.
Either of you want to comment on that? I don't know if we also have colleagues from WHO, perhaps, because they have addressed this issue. Maybe Christian is online, but if either of you want to comment on that.
I can take a step. So it's a very important question, and thank you so much for bringing up the question. You may need to direct your question to other UN agencies as well, who are much more involved in food aid deliveries in crisis areas, World Food Programme, UNICEF, just to name a few. But there are others. For FAO, that's not my area of expertise, so you may need to redirect your question to fao-newsroom@fao.org. That might be the easiest way, or if you know the people and can directly communicate with them to figure out what we did from FAO. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to you. In fact, we have a colleague, WHO, Tarek. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Rolando. And we already discussed this when Jeremy was talking. We have our way of delivering supplies to Gaza. We have teams on the ground. We have now, right now, 51 truck that is waiting, loaded with medical supplies to go to those few hospitals that are still functional. We need access. So what we need is really that we can bring in supplies, bring those supplies within Gaza to health facilities so they can function. Unfortunately, what is happening is just the opposite. There is no hospitals in North Gaza functional anymore. Yesterday, WHO team went to Indonesian hospital and basically evacuated all remaining patients and medical staff, and now that hospital is completely empty. So I don't think it's a question of sending supplies by plane. It's about really finally getting the full unhindered access, so WHO but also everyone else can bring to Gaza what is needed.
Thank you very much for chiming in, Tarek, to help out with that important angle. Do we have further questions for our colleagues, WHO, FAO, on world food safety? No, that's not the case. So thank you very much, both of you, for joining us here on this important initiative. We'll certainly spread the word. Last but not least, merci pour votre patience, Estelle Fach, who is the head of monitoring, evaluation, and communication at CAFI, otherwise known as the Central African Forest Initiative, who is here to announce a new partnership. So over to you, Estelle.
Thank you. Yes, so on June 5th, in 2 days, is World International Environment Day. And this is the day that Costa Rica has decided to join the Central African Forest Initiative. So, and really bring its expertise to help Central African countries, so six Central African countries in the Congo Basin, to save their forests. So this comes at a time where... Ma? J'ai fait un pardon. Je pensais faire le briefing en français. Vous préférez? Excusez-moi, je suis partie en anglais. Les chiffres de la déforestation sont quand même alarmants. Il y a quelques semaines, les nouveaux chiffres sont sortis pour 2024. Il y a 6,7 millions d'hectares dans le monde de forêts qui ont disparu. C'est 18 terrains de foot par minute qui s'évaporent. Et ça, c'est mondial et c'est deux fois plus qu'il y avait eu en 2023. Et sur la région du bassin du Congo, si on regarde la RDC, donc la République démocratique du Congo, on est à 150% de déforestation en plus que juste l'année dernière. Donc ça, voilà, cette coopération partenariat, c'est une bonne nouvelle dans un océan de mauvaises nouvelles où la coopération internationale sur le changement climatique, sur l'aide au développement est aussi parfois questionnée. Et nous, on trouve que ce nouveau partenariat pose les bases de quelque chose de vraiment nouveau. D'abord parce qu'on parle de deux pays d'un pays forestier et d'une région forestière. On parle du Costa Rica qui a réussi à devenir un pays développé en augmentant son couvert forestier, en haletant la déforestation et en passant de 28 à 57% de son territoire qui est maintenant recouvert par des forêts, tout en devenant un membre de l'OCDE. Ils ont rejoint il y a quelques années. Donc ça, c'est quand même un modèle de développement assez unique et assez peu courant. Et puis... ce partenariat donc, du Costa Rica, il se focalise sur les paiements pour services environnementaux. Ça, c'est un mécanisme qui a été éprouvé au Costa Rica, où en gros, on paye un agriculteur ou une communauté pour des hectares de foresterie durable ou d'agroforesterie ou de plantation durable, et on paye sur la performance. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a un contrat qui est établi, et si ce contrat est honoré, le paiement arrive, disons, de manière annuelle sur une période de 10 ans. Et c'est vraiment intéressant dans un contexte où il y a des questionnements, et c'est un petit peu différent d'une approche traditionnelle de don. Là, vraiment, il n'y a pas de paiement s'il n'y a pas de performance. Et le Costa Rica a donc vraiment démontré que c'était efficace. Ils ont mis 1,5 million d'hectares sous contrat de ces paiements pour services environnementaux. Quand on parle de l'Afrique centrale, on parle d'un potentiel énorme. On est donc chez CAFI, l'initiative pour la forêt de l'Afrique centrale, on a estimé qu'il y a 271 millions d'hectares de terre qui pourraient être mis sous contrat PSE. Donc ça peut être de l'agroforesterie, de la gestion durable des forêts, de la conservation communautaire. Ça permettrait de séquestrer 4,8 milliards de tonnes de CO2 chaque année, et d'injecter 73 milliards de dollars dans l'économie locale et bénéficier à peu près de 274 millions de personnes donc dans la région, puis ceux qui importent, par exemple, le charbon de la région. Et donc de permettre un développement avec de la nourriture de la food security et du charbon plus durable, etc. Donc cet accord entre le Costa Rica et CAFI va se signer ce jeudi à 17h à l'OMM. La cérémonie commence à 17h. Vous êtes tous, la presse est cordialement invitée. Ce sera en présence de Monsieur Guilherme Fernandez, l'ambassadeur du Costa Rica, de Agui Vérez, la directrice du PNUD à Genève, de Berta Pesti, qui est la chef du secrétariat de CAFI, de l'ambassadeur du Royaume-Uni, qui a la présidence de CAFI en ce moment. Et puis, voilà, nous vous ferons parvenir dans la journée ou à votre demande le communiqué de presse pour jeudi. Merci beaucoup.
C'est jeudi à 17h.
Jeudi 17h, okay. À l'OMM, WMO.
D'accord. Merci beaucoup, Estelle. Merci. Des questions pour Estelle? Non? Non? OK. So, thank you very much. Oh, pardon. Non? Non, pour moi? Is it for me? Or
yeah. Let's wait. On another issue.
Another issue, OK. Yeah. So I think there are no questions, so very clear. Thank you so much for your patience and for this important announcement, Estelle. Do you want to pose your question now? Because I have a few announcements, but let's take your question, Gabby, then I'll take my announcements. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Sorry for taking the microphone too often. On Sunday in Mexico, the election of judges and magistrates was held in Mexico. This means that the judiciary will be made up of people elected by popular vote and not for their ability or their career. So my question is, this is unusual in a democracy. It is the only country in the world that has done this. So judges and magistrates will be from the party in the power and not for their own capacity. So I'm wondering if the Secretary General or a UN office or someone on your office has something to say about this, because it's a serious issue, because you know what, democracy is three powers, independence of judiciary, and the judges are going to be from the party in the power, and
you know, the votes, Mexicans were not, citizens were not going to vote. It was a mess. So I think that, well, I just wanted to you know, to highlight this issue to your office.
Thank you for highlighting that. I don't have a specific comment other than to say that, as you well know, the UN is firmly supporting transparent, free, fair, peaceful elections in any country, either big elections, small elections. This is what we stand for, and this is what we try to promote. We've been involved in many electoral processes ourselves as monitors, observers, but you may need to pose your question to the Secretary General's office in New York. At the same time, human rights colleagues may have a comment on this. Again, I would just repeat, peaceful, transparent, free and fair elections on the merits of the actual qualifications of the candidates. But this is something that is determined, and we don't interfere in sovereign affairs in terms of elections. But of course, this is what we try to uphold and try to inspire others to uphold these high standards. But maybe check with human rights. They may have a more specific comment on that. So let me just announce a few things before we wrap up. We spoke about CASA, the Secretary General's statement, which you will have received yesterday, which talked about these horrific attacks on these Palestinians who are lining up to get food aid. The investigations have been called for. There's a statement to that effect that the Secretary General has shared with you yesterday. We also shared with you yesterday a statement on Yemen, on the one-year mark of the detention of UN and other UN personnel and other personnel in Yemen from NGOs in particular. 1 year on, they're still in detention. So this is a statement that speaks to that issue. We have a statement that we shared with you as well on the election of the new president of the General Assembly, Ms. Bayerbach, who, as you know, was a former foreign minister of Germany. That happened yesterday, so she's president-elect, will assume this important role in September. So the Secretary General issued a statement on this election yesterday, noting that, of course, she's assuming this important role at a difficult time where there are conflicts, climate catastrophe, poverty, and inequality, which continue to challenge the human family. That statement you have in your box. A few announcements on events. Today, so Thursday evening, the 5th of June, which is an important day, of course. It's UN Environment Day. We have an event, Sine Onu, our next popular event, Sine Onu event, taking place this Thursday, the 5th of June, to mark World Environment Day. You're all invited to this screening that will take place, as usual, at Cinerama on Rue de Carouge in Plein Palais at 6:45, and we'll screen the movie Nature, The Call for Reconciliation. And this will be followed by a discussion with the filmmaker, who you well know, the renowned photographer Yann Arthus-Bertrand. You might remember his film Human, which is a fabulous film. This one is equally fabulous. So it's at 6:45. This coming Thursday and you're all invited, colleagues, students. If you're around on Thursday, please come. It's free, and it's a lovely community event. In terms of UNEP, our colleagues from UNEP, the UN Environment Program, asked me to announce a few things, in particular that on the 3rd of June, which is today, the press release and video package distribution on plastic pollution in remote and mountainous areas. This press release will be issued today, which speaks to the Basel, Rotterdam, and Stockholm Conventions projects. And then on World Environment Day itself, on the 5th of June, in addition to the event I just mentioned, the cinema screening, we also have a World Environment Day concert at Victoria Hall, which you're invited to. It doesn't say what, no, 8:30, which is actually after our event. Almost finished here. Meetings. There are no treaty body, no human rights meetings this week, which is a rare, rare window throughout the calendar year. No human rights treaty body meetings. And I can only tell you that the conference on disarmament will have the The next public meeting will be announced soon, but I don't have details for you just for the moment. And almost done, sorry. We have Peacekeepers Day event. As you know, the observance is actually the 29th of May, but we ourselves here at the UN Office at Geneva are holding our event this afternoon to mark this important day, the International Day of United Nations Peacekeepers. And this will be done through a ceremony this afternoon at 4 p.m. in the park. I think the rain will disappear, so we'll have sun, inshallah. In the UN Memorial, at the UN Memorial in the Ariana Park. So that's at 4 p.m. And this year's theme, as we announced last week, is the future of peacekeeping. And of course, it reflects on the evolving role of peace operations and pays honor to the service and sacrifice to the various peacekeepers throughout the years. We have the Director General, Tatiana Vailovaya, who will be speaking, Mr. Laurent Attar-Bayrou, who's the president of the International Association of Peacekeepers. We have a Major General Major General Germaine Sewer, who's the head of international relations at the Swiss Armed Forces. And we have the ambassadors of Ghana and Italy representing troop-contributing countries taking part in this very important event this afternoon at 4 p.m., which you're cordially invited to. And I think this is the last note for me. Press conference, which I believe was announced by our colleagues at the Disaster Risk Reduction Office. This is taking place on the sidelines of their eighth session of the Global Platform for Disaster Risk Reduction at the CICG across the street. There's a press conference featuring the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Amina Mohammed, together with Patricia Danzi, who's the Director General of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, and Kamal Kishore, who is the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction and the head of the UNDRR. That's at 6 p.m. at the CICG. I know some of you who are registered. There's still space if you want to attend this event this afternoon. Phew, that's it for me. Questions? Nope. Okay. Well, I wish you a good afternoon and see you here. Not on Friday. Yes, Friday's a holiday. Don't show up unless you really, really want to. Friday and Monday are holidays. Yes, four-day weekend, everybody. So enjoy. Profit. I'll see you here on Tuesday next. Monday's Pentecost and Friday's Eid. Yep. See you Tuesday.